Hello, everyone, and welcome to another special edition of the NutGallery.com podcast. Today, we're interviewing the Fairmont Band. I'm Shooter.
And I'm Jason James. Hope you enjoy the interview. Let's welcome Neil Sabatino to the NutGallery.com. How are you doing today?
Good.
You released Wait and Hope on July 10th.
Yeah.
How has the release gone so far?
So far, it's selling pretty well all across the country at indie stores and that kind of thing. Most of the areas that we've hit before, like throughout the Midwest, like the Minneapolis area, Milwaukee, Chicago, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and up in the Northeast, like New England area. So we're pretty happy, and we just got to play New England area this weekend. We played Portland and New Hampshire, and both shows were pretty great. And we're looking forward to, you know, touring all summer and hitting a bunch of new areas as well.
All right. How did you go about getting together with this one? I guess my question is what made you want to do this album? Besides the obvious green issues.
Well, it's actually our fourth full length, and it's originally we didn't have any kind of concept behind it, but as we got closer to the recording time, it just we kind of got rid of all the poppier stuff and, well, not really the poppier stuff, the happier lyrical content and stuck with more of the darker things that we were writing, and that kind of helped pull together and have it has kind of a cohesiveness, you know, with these sarcastic kind of bitter lyrics that reflect a lot of the I guess, turmoil the band was going through throughout the 2 years that we were writing the record. So it reflects, like, we had a bunch of stuff go wrong for us with past labels, and we had a member leave the band, and just other debacles with touring and that kind of thing. So the same thing that, you know, every band has to deal with.
The title Wait and Hope, does that have any relation to the movie Count of Monte Cristo?
Well, it's actually from the Alexandre Dumas book. It's one of the last lines in the book, and it basically says that it's the sum of all human wisdom is the words wait and hope. And we kind of use something from this book because, as you could tell from the lyrical content, it's kind of it kind of has that same theme of revenge on the people who have, you know, done you wrong. So that's why we chose the title for it. And it's just loosely, like, we tried to stick with all kinds of, you know, we tried to throw, like some of the themes that are throughout the book, Count of Monte Cristo, into the record. Like, there's the one or two love songs, there's the bitter, you know, the bitter songs about, you know, the enemy and that kind of thing. And then there's also like, happiness is a million miles away. Self-explanatory, that could, you know, easily fit into the themes of the book, The Count of Monte Cristo. So,
you refer to the album as an autobiographical pop revenge anthems. What can you tell us about that?
Well, like I said, all the songs are pretty much autobiographical, just about things the band has been through over the last couple of years. I kind of don't like to go too in-depth into the stories because I like people to listen to the music and kind of come away with their own meaning. But, I mean, for me, when I was writing them, I was definitely talking about specific instances, you know, and specific things that were going on in my life when I was writing the songs. I mean, pretty much, but they're all pop songs. I mean, I think that's kind of what we're known for, is these kind of very poppy songs with very dark lyrical content, you know, like, the songs are very, I guess, like Lemonheads meets The Replacements kind of sounding, like, you know, like poppy type music with these, like, underlying themes of revenge and that kind of thing.
That's definitely an interesting combination. So pretty much listeners to this CD can kind of expect some of the stuff that's going to be the stuff that they've listened to on some of your other CDs, but just a darker feel to it.
Well, I think I think all of our records have always been kind of autobiographical, and in the first couple of years of Fairmont, Well, I'll go back to, like, our first record I wrote the week after I was kicked out of another band. And that band went on to be, like, kind of built a really big name over the last few years. The band was called Pensy Prep, and it's gained a lot of attention because of Frank from My Chemical Romance. So, like, a lot of kids pay attention to the first Fairmont record because it was pretty much written about, like, hating Pensy Prep and the situation, and it was very autobiographical as well. And I think as the albums moved on through the years, like, those kind of themes of dealing with that whole breakup, like, it's kind of in all the past Fairmont records, as well as dealing with the record label that we were on at the time, which was Eyeball Records. And I think, like, with the newer record, I think I just said it a lot better. It's some of the similar themes that were in the past three records before it, but I think they're more direct and to the point and just said in a better way, and I think the songs are just written better. I think it was also the first time we had a cohesive, like, lineup that was together for a good number of years, because the first couple albums we had members coming in and out of the band constantly, the three of us that have been in the band for, like, 3 years now, you know, writing the whole record.
Well, I guess you really got yourself some good job security there, because there's always going to be band member problems. You're always going to have people you don't like, and record labels that can screw people. So there's always going to be a lot of good stuff to write about as far as that goes.
Right. Well, actually, we kind of switched directions recently. We started writing kind of a biographical thing about a specific person. And we kind of changed gears because we never want to do the same thing more than once. And we're always trying to think of new and interesting ways to put together a record, you know, just be as artistic as, you know, as possible. Like, we always have big ideas for all of our records. It's just there's the money issue. Where I remember when I first was talking about doing this record, it was going to be a much shorter record. It was going to be, I think, 5 to 8 songs, or full electric version of the songs, and then do another 5 to 8 songs, the same songs, but with piano, violins, and acoustic guitars, and kind of like a mellow, stripped-down version of the same record, and it just never really panned out. And then I think around the same time, the Foo Fighters did something really similar, so then we kind of just dropped that whole concept and went with a straightforward record. So we're trying to do something. The next record that we're going to be doing after this, we're trying a whole different concept as well. So we're always trying to be cutting edge in some way, you know.
Cool. How have your views of music changed since your beginning days with Stick Figure Suicide?
Well, Stick Figure Suicide, I was one out of five people, and we were doing punk rock stuff, so it always was just power chord driven punk rock, and I didn't write any of the lyrics with that band. So I was always trying to be as busy as possible on the guitar, which I think was the downfall of really playing guitar. So I think I overcomplicated what I was playing just for the sake of, you know, because I think once I started writing songs to sing over, I think the songs themselves became a lot better because they weren't as busy guitar-wise. Because also the band that I was in after Stick Figure Suicide, Pensy Prep, I was just the lead guitarist, and there was, like, little guitar leads everywhere through every song, you know. And I think once I actually started, you know, writing songs, like writing the entire song and not having any collaboration with a group, which is what I did when I started Fairmont, I think the songwriting process, I just grew a lot from that in those couple of years between Stick Figure Suicide and starting Fairmont. And I think just there's a difference in when you're writing just 1/5 of a song as opposed to writing the entire song, like write up with the structure and the lyrics and the everything, the melodies and everything. So I'm trying to think.
Well, that makes a lot of sense.
I think overall also just the kind of music I listen to, like, I think I'm such a big fan of music that I'm always buying records and listening to all different stuff. And I think just as I got older, like, I started the band when I was like Fairmont when I was like 24. I'm, you know, 30 now. So I think your musical tastes just change, and I've, you know, expanded definitely on what I listened to over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years. So I think that all gets incorporated into the music somehow. And just, you know, if you listen back to the first Fairmont stuff to the newest stuff, there's, you could definitely hear that there's a lot more overall influence of the last 40 years of rock in the newer Fairmont, as opposed to the older stuff, which kind of sounded like in the moment of when it was written, sounded kind of like what was going on in the, in like the scene it was written, you know.
Well, you mentioned music tastes changing as you get older. You're not going to turn country on us, are you?
No, I wouldn't say that, but I do, you know, every once
we're
in a while I do.
Also, a lot of money now.
I do. Well, I love Johnny Cash, so there's, I'm definitely not against writing a country-ish song. I mean, and we do have a lot of acoustic-y stuff that, I guess you could say comes off.
Well, I don't mind country personally, but JJ over here doesn't like it very much, so.
But, yeah, I don't think I would ever go, I don't think I'd ever be able to go country, because all of our stuff is way faster than country. I mean, I think no matter what we do, it's going to always be kind of up-tempo. I don't think we're ever going to ever do anything that's like super slow at all or any, or I can't see adding slide guitars or any of that stuff either, you know?
Yeah.
Country instruments into our thing. I mean, we're pretty happy with the 3-piece it is, and it kind of comes off like a cross between like Husker Du and, I don't know, I'm trying to think of another famous 3-piece. Well, I guess even like Nirvana-ish, it's a kind of like a mix between those kind of 3-piece bands live, and I really enjoy that about us, like the simplicity of it and like the less is more, you know, style of writing that we have with everything we do.
Yeah, it really makes sense in what your previous statement. You're talking about how you had to write for 1/5 of a song when you're playing just lead guitar, and you got to try to make yourself known. You want to put a good part in there somewhere for yourself so you can kind of stand out during the thing. And when you're writing out the song all by yourself, writing out the whole thing, I can see where it, you can have a much more balanced type of thing, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
And that does... That
and
does.
I mean, like, I always keep in mind, though, later on that I may be adding things to it, like, in the recording, like piano or harmonica and that kind of thing, like, which we did on Wait and Hope. But, like, I think people who, like, actually buy the record and hear us on the record and hear, like, the very polished thing with piano behind everything, I think it's also enjoyable to see us live and see it stripped down to where it's just the 3-piece and it's kind of like a little heavier and a little grittier live. I mean, that was always my favorite part of seeing like a band live, was hearing them like gritty and live, like especially like, you know, like a 3-piece type band where there's things on the album that they definitely can't pull off live, and you're waiting to see how they're going to pull it off live, you know,
mm-hmm.
like that kind of thing. So I mean, I think that's one of the, I think that's where bands get carried away a little bit today, where they have to have everything on like, you know, like synth pads, and they have to have like all these, you know, like they have to have 20 members in the band so they can cover, you know, make their album, you know, pretty much sound exactly like their record live. You know, I think that kind of ruins a little bit of the live element of being in a band, you know?
Yeah. I appreciate that. I appreciate also the bands that sometimes their live songs sound nothing like the ones that are on their album at all. You know, they change it, and they, cause I mean, let's face it, if you're playing that stuff every day, you get kind of sick of it after a while, even if it's your own song, you know, and they improvise and change things up and make it sound a lot different. I think GNR was a big one for that, where their stuff didn't sound very much like what it did on the album.
I'm definitely a big fan of that.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, we kind of take the same approach to when we do a cover song. Like, we have a couple covers that we throw in the set every once in a while, and we totally, like, change them from the way the originals were. Like, we do a lot of 60s type stuff and then kind of turn them into rock songs. Like, right now we're doing the Velvet Underground, Femme Fatale, and Tommy James, I Think We're Alone Now. And they're totally, like, you know, we took them from being mellow 60s rock songs to, you know, being 3-piece, loud, gritty songs, so...
That's cool, too. I also enjoy that. I enjoy it when a band remakes a song that wasn't necessarily in the same tone and really makes it into something, you know, that you can bang your head to or something like that. It's definitely a cool thing.
Right. Well, we also did, we do a replacement cover, and they were a 4-piece band. So, like, I enjoy taking something that was 4-piece and trying to figure out a new arrangement to make it a 3-piece song, you know? like that kind of thing, always kind of cool to me.
What can you tell us about the other band members?
John, also known as Hambone, he's the bass player. He was in the band Pensy Prep with me, which was our last band, and we kind of had a really bad falling out back when Pensy Prep broke up, and it was a couple years later he called me on the phone, and he was in between bands, and we just kind of just started talking again, and he said he would help us out with, you know, playing bass, because at the time we were playing as a three-piece, but I was playing clean electric guitar. We had an acoustic guitarist and drums, and we were kind of like a mellower version of what Fairmont's doing now. And I started playing bass, and he originally said he was just temporary and fell in love with it and has stuck with it. You know, now, you know, he's been asked to join so many other bands and doesn't give them the time of day because he's, you know, with us for good, so... And he's become, like, an important part of the songwriting process as well. Like, a lot of time I'll bring songs to him, and he'll do the arrangement. Like, he'll help me with the arrangement or help me trim the fat off the songs. And as well, recently he's been writing more and more songs, and he'll give me, like, the skeleton of what will be a future Fairmont song, and then I'll kind of rework it and add some riffs over it and that kind of thing. And Andy, we found... He actually joined right before John did. We found him when we were kind of in a pinch, ready to go record an album with a week's time, because our drummer had just totally flaked out on us. And within a week, he learned our entire record and played on the Onami record, and has been just great about, like, touring ever since, and is, you know, just really super enthusiastic, and he kind of has, like, a very his big influence is Guided by Voices and a lot of indie stuff like that. And he never really overplays, but he adds just, like, the exact, you know, right touch to every song. Like, I rarely ever have to ask him, oh, could you do this or do this? He kind of just knows, like, I guess from playing with me for so many years now, that, you know, exactly what I want the drums to be like for that song.
That's got to make things easier.
It definitely does. I mean, we usually, when we're writing songs, they usually come very... We write them within, like, I bring a song to practice, and within, you know, like, an hour, it's together and really tight between all three of us, which definitely wasn't the case in the past with other members and with other people I've played with. So just playing with these guys for I think, just we have a real good work ethic together.
What is the best part of writing and performing music?
I would say, like, you know, like, I would be writing whether or not I was performing for anybody or showing anybody. Just to, I guess to I create music that I like, that I love, you know, I like the way it sounds, you know, like it's so I mean, like, even if there was no audience for it, I would still be making music. It's just like this thing inside of me that I have to keep making music. I mean, it is great though when you connect with an audience when you're playing and you see people singing along and that kind of thing. I mean, that's definitely the best part, is when you go to some new town that you've never been to before and people are singing along to your songs and that kind of thing. Or, you know, because especially with how the market is, and it's amazing to me that we can even make new fans. It seems like there's, like, so many bands, and, like, everything is so oversaturated, and we're not one of those bands who are, like, we're just not, like, in people's faces like other bands are. Like, we don't send out 5,000 bulletins a day on MySpace, and we don't, you know, pummel people with, you know, like, flyers and all that kind of stuff, and, like, you know, trying to get on Warped Tour and play every single festival available and try to play with, you know, major label acts constantly, like, in the local area. I think we kind of just do our own thing, so we're always amazed that we're even making fans, but we are, and more than some of the bands that are kind of like that are pumping, like, thousands and thousands of dollars into their band, like, into futile things, like, you know, like, getting on Warped and, you know, putting ads up all over the internet and things like that, you know.
And doing interviewers artists with...
on MySpace.
And doing interviews with podcasters, huh? I think,
well, I mean, that kind of thing. I mean, you know, like... I guess there's a fine line we walk with that, but I mean, like, we want to, of of course, we have a publicist and all. Like, we do want people to know when we're doing something. Just I think there's a right way to do it and a wrong way to do it, you know?
Yeah, so there's like going to be no Kung Fu Grip Neil action figures coming out anytime soon that you can
put out your... Most likely not. Well, we're not opposed to that kind of thing either. But I don't think we'd ever be I don't know. If there was enough money behind us and they wanted to turn us into the next Kiss, I don't know. But except I'm not wearing makeup, they'd have to do a action figure of me wearing jeans and a t-shirt. But
back to your previous statement, I do think it's very important in any artistic field that you write it and make it for yourself. So I think that really does come through, and I think that helps grab an audience when you're doing it for yourself instead of cranking something out that you know is going to sell. I think.
Well, if I'm going to have to play it for like 70 to 100 shows a year, I definitely has to be something that, you know, like I'm going to enjoy playing that many times and that I'm going to have some feeling behind every time I'm playing it, you know. Like I don't understand how some bands can write just like stuff that's trendy or they know is going to be popular, you know.
Yep. I suppose I can understand it. I play guitar and I'm the first person to say that I suck really bad, but I do it for myself and I do it behind closed doors most of the time and I just do it for fun. And I can see how you can, if you end up getting good at it, like you, then you can end up actually making some songs for other people to hear. So I can understand.
Right.
I think you kind of answered this before, but I guess, so my guess on this one is if between performing live or doing recording in a recording studio, you definitely like performing live much better, right?
It's two different experiences. Like when you're in a recording studio, I really enjoy that aspect of really sitting down with the songs and getting like the perfect tones on all the instruments and making it, you know, sound like you've never heard that song before. Like getting that song to like the best point possible to, you know, for I guess maximum enjoyment for myself. You know, hearing that song like as pristine as you can make it in the studio. But yeah, I mean, it would get boring if all you were doing is recording in a studio. I enjoy that process is only like once every year or once every 2 years or whatever, you know. Like I really enjoy playing out live, you know. Like I think it's a little bit of low self-esteem with me, but I need to see that, you know, like that people are enjoying what we're doing to know that we're on the right page.
Can you maybe step us through the writing process you go through when you go to write a song? Or
sure. Well, most of the time I will just start with the guitar, like finding, like, you know, it mostly all starts around with just fooling around playing guitar, and then you play something and you, like, I just know right off the top of my head either this is going to be great for an intro or for a verse or for a chorus. And right from there I start to just construct the whole entire song musically, and usually the first thing I'll write is a chorus, and then I'll build the verses off the chorus, and then the last thing I'll put in is a bridge, you know, like, and try to, but I one thing I always try to do is keep it very, I try not to get overcomplicated lyrically, because in the beginning, I think I used to write a lot of songs that were like story within a song, and fit every detail of that story in the song, and it just, I think some of the songs got a little too long, and I think like I just had a problem editing myself. And one thing I think I've done more recently was I think everything that I write, I kind of now am starting to try to write it less specific so that other people can listen to the song and kind of put themselves in that situation so they can relate it to their own lives. And I think if you get too specific, like some of my older songs, it mentions people by name and that kind of thing. I think people have a harder time relating to that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying. I think it's kind of important. It might be kind of hard to do, but to like get your songs a little bit less specific, a little bit less lyric-wise, let the music tell a little bit of the story, then have to trust in the fans to understand what you're trying to come across. And I suppose if maybe it takes a little while to get that trust.
Now we're going back the opposite way with some of the new material that we're writing, because we're writing kind of a biography of somebody. So, but I think it's going to come off as the best stuff we've done. I think I've learned, like, over the years, because I've done writing both ways, and I think the newer stuff we're writing is kind of a really good combination of both. It gets, you know, it gets specific, but not just not too specific, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you can understand.
I think so. I think I understand what you're trying to say.
Well, I always think, like, artists, like, and musicians and everybody just sounds so pretentious in interviews and, like, trying to explain their art, you know? Like, I don't know, I went to art school, so years and years of that, just, I feel like a tool a little bit.
Oh, now, well, kind of along the same lines about you're doing the biographical stuff, and is there anybody that you would actually like to collaborate with? In an actual song, instead of just maybe writing a song about them or something like that.
Well, we asked this girl Teeter from, she was in a band called Lay Royal Scam, and she's doing a new band called Lady Birds that have a record coming out in August on Creep Records, and she had guest vocals on it from me and Matt Pryor from the Get Up Kids and Max from Say Anything, and she's been one of my favorite people to have come and sing on my stuff, and, like, I'm kind of writing her in, like, with, as the last record, we just asked her to come and sing on her stuff because we both had a mutual friend, and I really loved her voice, and I think now with the new record, I'm kind of writing stuff specifically for her, whereas the last record, she just came in and sang, and she's always, I think she just has a really great tone to her voice with my voice, and I'm looking forward to collaborating more and more with her in the future on stuff. I wish that she was available to, like, join the band full time, but she lives on the West Coast. And I'm trying to say, other people, we have friends on a band called The Minus Scale, and we kind of bounce ideas off of them constantly. And I even talked with their singer about us possibly doing an acoustic-y project together. But, I mean, aside from that, you mean, like, famous people I would want to collaborate with? Or
sure.
Like, anybody? Or I don't know. It'd be nice to sit down with Bob Dylan and, you know, play through a couple songs. But I imagine he might be difficult. So
yeah.
I'll settle with, you know, the friends I have that I enjoy their music and they enjoy my music and, you know, see what comes of it. Like, I think with specifically with Ryan from The Minus Scale, like, we both have a similar take, I think, on writing. He's somebody I definitely bounce ideas off of constantly. Like, anytime I finish, like, a home demo, him and the other guy from the group, AJ, I send them songs constantly and ask them what they think of it, and they'll give me criticism and that kind of thing. So I kind of already do collaborate with them in a way. Like, actually, Wait and Hope, we did an entire demo of the record a year before we went to record it. There was pretty much a finished demo, and we handed it out to a bunch of our friends and kind of asked for feedback on it, and we ended up kind of rewriting more than half the record at that point and adding a bunch of new songs because it was actually going in a much more mellow direction originally.
Well, kind of on a different note, you've been touring quite a bit. What's life like been on the road?
We've noticed every single tour gets better and better. So we've been playing better rooms, bigger rooms, in front of more people. So we're hoping that continues. You know, we're now at the point where we're at least coming back and we're profiting from the tours and not just breaking even or losing money. So that's definitely a plus. We're still trying to figure out, though, if we're a 21-plus band or an all-ages band, because sometimes, like, when you're playing bars, people don't really want to pay attention because they're drinking, and, you know, the last thing they want to hear is loud bands and that kind of thing. So, like, we've been able to win over a lot of those crowds over the last couple tours, and with all-ages, we're just not as screamy or as we're not really doing what the all-ages scene is into right now. So we're always trying to find where we fit in different markets. like a good example is we played Minnesota on our last tour, and we had a 21 plus show in Minneapolis, and then in Mankato we had an all. I assume that the all ages show is going to have much more people at it, and kids were going to definitely be excited to see us and buy our CDs. And the 21 plus show was just a bar show, so it was going to be difficult to sell anything because people want to spend their money on alcohol. And it turned out when we played the 21 plus show, everybody in the room was out of their seats, pressed against the stage, loving everything that we did. We sold like a ton of CDs and T-shirts, and basically they bought everything that we had brought with them. And then we go and play the all ages show, and it's the complete opposite, where kids look at us like we have 10 heads. And they just don't get what kind of music we're playing. They have no reference because they don't know about, you know, a lot of the 90s bands that were influenced by, or 80s bands that were influenced by, and 60s, forget about it. They don't even know who the Velvet Underground or anything like that is. So it's always trying to find that fine line of who will, you know, we're still searching out the audience, which I think you can't really do. We kind of have to let that, like, we have to let them find us, and people live and go play those areas, you know, because I think us searching for that audience is always a difficult task. But like I said, the rooms have been getting better, bigger, and, you know, doing a lot better than we have in the past. We're playing all major cities, so I can't complain.
So, you know, along the same lines as that, I guess, is, you know, you've given us a few of those examples of the different places you performed at. I mean, did you have anything real strange happen? Like maybe you were at a 21 over show, you had to play the band in a cage and people were throwing beer bottles at you or anything like that? Anything really weird that happened to you on the road or while touring live?
Luckily, the last couple tours have been awesome. Except for, well, we did a tour in February when all of Route 80 in Pennsylvania was closed because of icing over. And they sent us on a four-hour detour through, like, these back mountain-type towns. And it was – that was kind of hell. And we had to be in Michigan the next day, and it took us forever to get there. And then the night we got there, we play the show, and then we're on our way to Chicago and blizzard. And it takes us, like 6 or 7 hours instead of 4 hours to get to Chicago. And the weather that trip definitely killed us. Like, was just, like – it was one of the worst trips just driving-wise, not because of any of the venues or anything like that. All the shows were great. But, I mean, in earlier tours, we've played a couple nightmare places, like places that booked us and told us that they have rock bands all the time, but they actually – there's this one place in Cleveland told us they had rock bands come through all the time. And we get there, and it's like this little log cabin-type place, and it's on a college campus. And as soon as we start bringing our equipment in, the guy just has this frown on his face and is looking like, there's no way this is going to fly. It was pretty much more an acoustic-y venue, and I guess as soon as we turned on anything, the guy came over and made us lower our amps were barely at one. Like, you could barely hear him. It was like an electric guitar with no amp. And our drummer had to play with brushes, and the guy was just a real, real dick to us. And friends of ours who are like this six-piece band also were on the bill called The Finals. They're on Immortal Records, but they like, there was no way they were going to be able to play because they're like one of the loudest bands I've ever played with. And we have, you know, they wheel all their amps in, and we knew it was going to be a bad show right from the start. So we played a couple songs, and then we traded, and we let them go up and play a couple songs, and we played a couple songs just so that we both didn't have to suffer through an entire set, because, like, there was hardly any people there. Nobody was coming inside, and it was just terrible. And the guy, as the Finals took their second set on stage, the guy turned off the lights and told them they had no talent, and it was time for us to all pack up and go home. So that was definitely one of the worst experiences ever at a club. Trying to think, we've had that where we showed up and there was supposed to be a local on the bill, and the local on the bill drew like one person. It's like that band and their girlfriend. One girlfriend came out to see them, and that happened to us in Milwaukee once, and that happened to us as well once in Illinois. And it was just like, just you learn what places not to play, you know. And that's how you also you meet people and find out who, you know, where the really good clubs are and who the right people to talk to are, you know. So luckily, I guess we've been doing something right because we haven't had any experiences like those in a year or two. So that definitely, you know, it's just you have to be out there and traveling to the same cities over and over again to learn their scene pretty much and learn what bands, you know, that you want to hook up with and what venues are going to, you know, treat a touring band right and make sure you're always playing in front of people and that kind of thing. So luckily we've had really good luck in like Chicago and places like that, Chicago, Minneapolis, Cleveland, Pittsburgh.
You do seem to tour mostly Midwest and Eastern.
Right.
So you kind
of... I flew to do a couple shows on the West Coast. I did a show in Seattle and a couple in Portland. And they were okay, but there's just no overwhelming response to Fairmont out there. So... like, the problem is, once you get past Minneapolis, there's not a whole lot of states to play between there and Seattle, like, for us to start building a following. And we only get off, we're older guys, we all have day jobs. We can only get off a couple weeks at a time, and we've been hitting these areas constantly. So we figure, you know, let's build our following in all the major cities that we're doing well in, instead of wasting time trying to hit the entire country. Whereas we'll only, if we did California tours, we'd probably only be able to hit California once a year. If we keep the tours to hitting the Midwest, we can hit Minneapolis 3 times a year. And, you know, it's just, I think it's been beneficial in helping us build a following. Whereas if we tried to cover too much area, I think we would end up covering the areas a lot less. And, you know, you really have to hit an area a lot before you start building a following. Like, it was probably the 7th or 8th show we played in Chicago was when we started to have people coming back out. You know, like, you can't just hit an area once or twice and expect to be big there. So, I mean, that's part of our overall, I guess, plan with touring is to keep hitting the areas that we do well and over again. I mean, we're starting to build a following in California. I guess we're going to wait just until we have to go there. To fly out there, and I mean, we're hoping to. It's kind of it's a rough drive from New Jersey. So, like I said, and we don't always get enough time off of work. We may have to find a band out there that's cool enough to lend us some gear and fly out there to do shows.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. I mean, I know there's a couple like more local bands around here. Like one of them's name is Road Trip, and I know that everybody around here turns out as soon as they're going to be playing somewhere. There's going to be a bunch of people that's going to turn out to go watch that one just because they're known locally to be a good band. Right. And I can see how you have to try to get on the venue with somebody that you know, if you're going to go to a new place that you know they're going to draw somebody so that they got plenty of people to watch you and get a little bit of publicity that way too.
Right. Well, this summer we're trying like a good number of new markets. I think we're trying like 7 or 8 new markets, and there are markets that we can easily hit again, and we've kind of, like, tried to do our homework as much as possible on the markets and find, you know, what bands we're going to fit with well. And been talking to fans, like, through MySpace and that kind of thing and finding out, you know, what places they like to go see shows at and, you know, kind of thing, I guess. Just trying to do as much work in advance so that when we get out there for the shows that they'll be worthwhile, you know. Like, we've never hit, like, I think we're trying, well, we've played Washington, D.C. before, but that's where we kind of start. We're playing Philly, Washington, D.C., North Carolina, Nashville, Kentucky we've played before. I'm trying to think where our heads are. Then Indiana, I think then we're going through St. Louis, Kansas, Omaha. So those are a bunch of new areas that we haven't played before. And then the following week after that, we're hitting all the markets that we've hit before and done really well in, like, Minneapolis, Chicago, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, home, you know, like, New York City, Boston area, all that kind of stuff.
Now, did you grow up playing music and writing music?
I always had, like, a keyboard, like, a Casio keyboard that I was always fooling around on from, like, a really young age. I just never wanted to. When I was, you know, 17, a friend of mine was an incredible bass player, and I said, hey, if I get my parents to buy me a bass for Christmas, do you think you could give me some lessons? So I got a bass. He gave me, like, 4 lessons, told me I knew everything I needed to know, and basically because he didn't have time to give me lessons anymore. And I kind of just figured it out myself from playing keyboard before, was able to, like, kind of just figure out songs, like, all by ear, and then, I don't know, just eventually switched to guitar, and I've been playing ever since. I think I was doing a band, like, probably 2 weeks after I got my first bass, like, had found a drummer and a guitarist and was doing the band thing, so, like, I've always, just right from the beginning, knew I wanted to be in a band type situation and be in a band. I don't think I started taking it very seriously as an entity that I wanted to release records and do it on that kind of scale until I was, Suicide was the first band I was in that, like, actually wanted to tour, put out records, and played, you know, 4 nights a week, you know, all over, so.
Right. I guess, some of the questions that we're getting kind of near the end of the questions that we got for you here, and okay. And one of them was one of the big ones. It might be kind of a long answer here. Is what gives you the inspiration these days? I mean, are there any books or music that you'd like to recommend to the people that might listen to this podcast or go to our website that are kind of inspiring or to you?
I've kind of recently been reading a lot of existential novels, like The Stranger by Albert Camus, and a lot of Jean-Paul Sartre's work. He has this gigantic book called Being and Nothingness that is just all about, like, philosophies on existentialism. And I always find that stuff interesting. I don't know if I fully, like, in the idea of the universe, you know, has no meaning and it's all chaos, but I always find that interesting and kind of, I think, incorporate a little bit of that into the writing. I think with our new, the new stuff that we're kind of working on, like I said, it's going to be a biography of this friend of ours who we met and has this, like, really crazy life. Like, he just, I'll go into it a little bit, because he was in fifth grade. His parents took him out of school because, because they said the apocalypse was coming, and they moved them to a farm real far away from civilization and swore off technology and, like, taught him to shoot a gun and told him the apocalypse was coming any day and he had to prepare to die. And they were all, like, spiritualists that talked to the dead. And so we're pretty much basing our whole next album on this, on the biography of this kid. Who
sounds like a good and interesting album.
So I've been doing a lot of like, kind of the concept for our, I'm kind of writing, like, a 15-page short story about it, about him and his life, and, like, kind of the whole story is about him finding, like, true love and this whole kind of romantic type thing, but he's kind of, like, a damaged person who's been waiting to die since he was, like, in fifth grade, because his parents were telling him the apocalypse was coming, and he kind of had no plan for life, and, I don't know, kind of deep, and he we're using that as inspiration, and like I said, we're gonna try to put out, like, pretty much like a mini book, and then the CD that we're writing that goes along with it is pretty much the soundtrack to the story, and it's gonna be an illustrated, like, kind of almost like a children's book, but not for children. So that's kind of what's current inspiration, and John, the bass player, for a real long time, he had trouble writing songs. When I was in Penn, like, most of those songs that we used with that band, and he just hasn't written songs since. And this kind of inspired him to sit down and start writing songs again. So some of the stuff that we're coming up with together is very interesting. And we've kind of just been collecting lyrics. But because we had a new record, even though this record's been pretty much written for 2 years and it's just coming out now, we have a new record that just came out, so we're kind of putting a lot of that stuff on the shelf because we have to play the songs off of this record live, you know, so we're trying not to get too ahead of ourselves. But I mean, that's kind of where we're at now. I mean, because it got too hard to, like, a lot of the past records are all about just bad relationships that I've gone through, like, just being in the music scene with, like, just battles with ex-band members, labels, all that kind of thing. And I think I kind of got all of that out of my system with the Wait and Hope record. Like all the bitter stories of, you know, of my fighting with, so that's why I needed to move on and do something, I think, a little more positive than bashing other people. So that's kind of where we're at now, but, like, as our, for our writing process. I mean, I never had a problem coming up with songs, and like I'm also looking into like I have like albums and albums worth of material saved that we never got to use for anything, and I'm always like combing through that stuff to see if any of it'll work with current things that we're doing. So.
Well, that concludes our questioning, but we have a segment at the end we like to do called Rapid Fire. It's okay. Just five questions, and you just answer short form or...
Yeah,
just,
first thing that comes to mind kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So if you're... the first question is, what have you been listening to recently?
I'm trying to think. Well, see, I have this friend who works at this music marketing company. They're the same people who are Mark hands me handfuls of CDs. I pretty much listen to whatever he puts on my desk, and... he does a lot of stuff for Barstooks, so Rocky Votolato, Not a Surf stuff, and like all that kind of stuff is a lot of what we've been listening to. The band Menomina, I don't know if you know them. Trying to think. And then I always kind of have this like classic stuff that I'm always listening to, like just 90s alternative stuff and like early 80s indie like Replacements and Husker Du and that kind of stuff. And I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan, and I just kind of, I think with the invention of the iPod, we just leave the iPod on shuffle and shuffle through, like, you know, the last 40 years in music all randomly and just listen to whatever pops up.
I do that a lot, too. The second one, describe yourself in three words.
Three words. Do I have to be honest about that, or can I just, you know, awesome,
you can...
awesome?
You can just lie. It's fine. I never said I had to tell the truth in these questions.
I don't know. That's a tough one. Can we skip that one?
Sure. Who is the most influential person in your life?
Actually, can I go back to that one? I think I'm too complex for three words.
Okay.
So complicated. All right, that works.
Who is the most influential person in your life?
Wow, these are really hard for rapid-fire type questions.
Yep, that's the point.
I think my wife, I guess, would be probably the most influential person in my life. Like, that's...
Good answer.
I think I bounce ideas off of her way before I bounce them off of anybody else, and. Yeah, so pretty much if she says something sounds like stupid or anything, it just gets buried and I never use it. And then if she says something is awesome, that's pretty much the next thing, you know. So I'd have to say, yeah, probably her.
One person you'd like to meet.
Is this like living or dead or living?
Either way.
One. I don't know, maybe Django Reinhardt. You guys know him?
You can enlighten us a little bit on that one, maybe.
Oh, he's like this famous 30s guitarist. I would love to just like sit down and listen to him play guitar. He plays like this unreal, like he plays faster than people in metal bands. And he was doing that like back in like the 30s and like just like probably the best guitarist that has ever lived.
Cool.
I think I say him because... like if I said like Bob Dylan or somebody who I like, I know they would turn out to just be a prick and would totally ruin my whole image of them. So I would stay away from the super famous people that I, you know.
Good call. The final one, if you had unlimited power to change one thing in the world, what would it be?
I don't know. There's lots of stuff that needs to be changed in this world. So I don't know. I guess, I don't know. Cure all disease.
There you go.
Right.
Well, at the end, we always like to open it up and allow you to add in anything that we haven't asked you or talk about anything you'd like to talk about. So the floor is yours.
Well, I just definitely want to mention the Ladybirds record. Like I said before, it's coming out on Creep Records on, I think it's in August. And that's Teeter Sperber, who sang on our record, Wait and Hope. She sings on three songs on Fairmont's Wait and Hope, and I sing on one song on their record, and also guest starring on that record is Max from Say Anything and Matt from the Get Up Kids. And I'm trying to think, we'll be on the road all summer. Just check our MySpace for tour dates and all, and the record should be in stores everywhere, and people can, you know, if they have a favorite indie store, they definitely should tell them to order it if they're not carrying it. I think that's about it. Our whole back catalog is on iTunes, and we have a bunch of cool videos up on YouTube, like just stuff from tours and like live videos and a video for our new single and old videos from past albums. So that's, if you go to the FairmontMusic.com webpage, you can get links to all that. And then there's also a ton of information on FairmontMusic.com, like bios about the band and that kind of thing. And also, like I said, me and John used to be in a band called Pensy Prep, and that album just got recently re-released on Eyeball Records. And there's also T-shirts available for that band, and that's all at myspace.com/PensyPrep. I think that's about it. That's all my...
Well, you're actually going to be doing a location very near where we are in Madison, Wisconsin, so maybe we'll run over there and check you out.
Cool, yes. We're playing the Annex. I think that's the 22nd of August.
Yep.
So, and I heard the bands that we're playing with are... I heard Stephanie Rierich. I think she's like a real big local, supposedly. I don't know. Hopefully you've heard of her.
Yeah, if you, I can give you one tip. If you want to bring out any covers for that one at all, do something by Cheap Trick, and you'll get the whole town.
Good to go.
Yeah.
Well, we actually used to do "I Want You to Want Me" back a while ago, so maybe we'll throw that back.
Yeah. Put that on your cover list. They came from Madison, so everybody likes that around here.
Okay. Well, no problem.
At the end here, we're going to play Suspicion Haunts the Guilty Mind. Anything you want to mention on that song?
That song is kind of actually about the songwriting process for me. I think I was kind of talking about a couple of different people when I was writing that, just like people who kind of feel like they're pulling one over on us. But they're really not. Like, we know their whole hidden agenda. I think that's kind of what that song is mostly about. But it's also about the songwriting process. It kind of, one of the lines is, the chorus is, "You ruined everything. You're the reason why I sing. You're the reason I scream and shout. It helps to let all the demons out." And that's kind of just about, like, how these kind of people, you know, I kind of just take it all in and put it into song, and that's how I deal with those kind of people. So I guess take that for what it's worth.
All right, well, it's been fun. I wish you good luck on the rest of your tour and in your future adventures.
Hopefully we'll see you guys in Madison then.
Sure.
Let us know. We'll put you on the guest list.
All right.
Well,
and it was very nice talking to you, and let us know when the interview's open.